Welcome to episode number 4 of The Exchange, presented by Confederation Group. The Exchange is PEI's public affairs podcast, giving you an up-to-date analysis on what's occurring on our island. I'm Sam McPhail, and with me, like always, is my co-host Blake Doyle. How are you doing today, Blake?
I am just as usual. I'm great. Things are great. Things couldn't be happier.
It's been a pretty wild week in terms of both political nature and the economy with ongoing issues. What have you heard the past week?
Every week is exciting with the economy. We did an article this week on the coronavirus.
A topic of interest for many people.
It is. Some people had comments on it, but I think the general issue with corona is that it's here to stay. It'll be here for a bit. Probably we'll all be affected, or some significant portion of the economy and society will be, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about the economic impacts. We can talk about the article. But probably the most exciting thing is the guest that we had on this past week.
Yeah, big time. I think this was a great guest to have on, a PEI proud, Summerside proud. Spent a lot of time in the NHL, both as a coach, a GM, an executive, and then a time as an analyst too. So really couldn't find anyone better for this to kind of bump up our stature maybe a bit. But no, it was awesome that Doug could call in from his house in Florida, where he spends his winters, and he'll be back soon enough, he said, for the summer months.
He's had a big impact on Summerside. He's brought a lot of people from Summerside into his folds, and he's really been an advocate for the talent that we have here locally.
Right.
And his next career is going to be author.
Author, yeah. He's in the process of writing a book, and he kind of touches on that at the start of the interview. It's pretty... Just his knowledge of what he's seen in over 30 years, that we can't compare it to anything because there is no NHL team. There is not really that person that's been in the game that long. So it's going to be kind of cool to see how he went from someone who was teaching high school in Summerside to someone who's at the highest level at the NHL as a president of a new hockey team. So.
And successful. Both him and some of the colleagues he's had, like Turk.
Exactly, yeah. And that's kind of what he brought, that PEI mentality of always bring along people. Bring your closest people with you, because that's just how kind of the PEI mentality works, I guess. This past week, on Sunday, March 8th, was International Women's Day.
Well, we are big supporters of women in this office.
We're
the only men.
That's true. We have a lot of great women who work with us at our home, in our community. So we want to definitely thank all the contributions that women in our lives make, and more so, I guess, a focus on Sunday, or this past weekend, was the...
Speaking of women,
the UPEI women's basketball team defeated Laval University in the bronze medal game, so to be third overall in Canada at university basketball is pretty incredible, and they have the player of the year, who happens to be from Charlottetown, your neck of the woods. Jenna Mae Ellsworth won the Nan Kopp Award, which is, like I said, the Women's Basketball Player of the Year for all of Canada. So that's really incredible. I've never been that good at basketball, but to be able to say someone that I went to school with, to say that someone who plays on my university team is the best basketball player in Canada,
it's quite an accomplishment. I don't know Jenna Mae. From observing her in the community, she seems like a very well-grounded young lady. I'm sure she'll have a very dynamic career. And she's not only been a leader in this basketball team, but she's an academic performing student as well. So I think all these students, we talked to Lee Reed a couple of weeks ago, any of these students on any of these teams also have to be committed to their academics.
Like double pressure almost, that they want to perform both in school and on the court. And that's what makes them into great citizens, is that they have that work ethic in both the court and or the rink, wherever they want to be, and in the classroom as well.
So great graduates coming out of UPEI. I'm sitting with one here right now who's going to graduate this spring. So
a couple more months to go.
We're creating tremendous citizens, and the future looks very promising.
So looking forward to the latter part of this week, the U Sports Women's Hockey Nationals are underway Thursday at the McLaughlin Arena, the Bell Alliance Center. And this is the second year in a row that UPEI Women's have hosted it, but this year the team is...
in it.
A lot better. They're not just going there as a show goat. They're actually there to play, and they have a tough the first game versus the University of Alberta, but that's on Friday night at 7 p.m. But I'm going to be there cheering them on, because I think they can. You never know what could happen. Stranger things have happened.
Well, home ice advantage.
Exactly.
We've got a strong crowd supporting the team.
A thousand plus people there. You never know what could happen.
So you don't dismiss that. That's a pretty important event for PEI. Now, it'll be interesting to see what happens next year. We've had some hockey events canceled.
Right, yeah, with the virus. And it's hard to say what, because there's, like, next year, I guess, Summerside's supposed to host the
and Charlottetown.
And Charlottetown, the under 17. So let's not look too forward. But the women's... IIHF hockey tournament in Halifax was canceled. Yeah. But they guaranteed it next year it's going to be in Halifax, pending that...
As long as everybody's inoculated. <for that time. laughs>
Pending quarantine ending. But that's probably a good place to segue into our first segment of the day, is political pundits. So what politically has happened in the past week that you'd like to analyze?
I think the biggest, there's lots of things, of course. Every week, PEI revolves around politics, which is why we do this podcast. You know, this evolving coronavirus situation, which, you know, we can't live in fear. And I think this thing is way oversubscribed. Certainly the run, if you use that pun, on toilet paper is just ridiculous. You know, people are stockpiling things they shouldn't be, and that creates an artificial economy. But I don't think you could buy hand sanitizer probably in North America. I'm sure, actually, we should look at...
Check on Amazon. I think it was
200
like,
bucks
like
or something.
500 milliliters was over $100.
Yeah, so it's pretty
It's expensive as is, but now it's just blown through the roof.
We have some here. We could sell it.
We're buying stocks in Purell this week.
Well, you wouldn't want to buy stocks in travel companies. They're all reporting pretty negative impacts. But I think locally, we did get a pretty stern... not stern, but a well-positioned statement from the public health officer.
Right. So Dr. Heather Morrison announced Monday that islanders need to take extreme caution when traveling due to coronavirus and avoid cruise ships altogether. Yeah, so I won't be going on a cruise ship anytime soon. I don't know about you.
Well, even I think nationally they said just stay off of cruise ships.
Stay off boats, yeah.
Which is quite a statement. So if you're in the cruise ship industry, and I forget, PEI has about $25 million in contributions from cruise ships, I think, last year. How does that affect the economy? And how does that affect the people, you know, involved in that industry, the workers, the shareholders? Big, big statements.
It's pretty crazy. Nationally, actually, to kind of heat up I don't know if heat up's the right word because it's pretty boring if you ask me, but the conservative leadership race.
Oh, come now. Hold on a second. That's the best show in town.
Some news in that Alberta Premier Jason Kenney backed Aaron O'Toole as his preferred candidate. So that's a pretty strong Tory base backing from someone who probably maybe not expected it, because a lot of times, not that they're forced to, but sometimes premiers that are in power don't want to take sides because it could affect them down the road.
Yep.
But having Jason Kenney, who is the most anti-Trudeau.
Oh, yeah, he's not hedging anything with Trudeau.
But what if Peter McKay wins and he says, no, Jason, you weren't on my side?
Which will.
Not that Peter McKay will inevitably win. There's a lot of people in the race, but Aaron O'Toole and Peter McKay are the two front runners.
So I think for sure there'll be some ramifications to taking positions on these things, and that's a little bit petty. If not...
No, you're right. It's hard to imagine someone taking a stance like that, especially in an incumbent position, but who knows what'll happen.
It may be an attempt to divert from his budgetary challenges.
Right, his oil issues out there.
That's a big, you know, the drop in oil price, which there's some sort of a balance of oil, which is probably around $60 a barrel, and we're not near that. Eventually OPEC will get organized again, and they'll collude, and the price will come back to some sort of proximity to where it should be trading. But this is a strange time for markets
and for being a politician.
It's not an easy time.
It's not a rewarding time at all. So back to locally, yesterday Minister Stephen Myers and some other MLAs and also municipal leaders took a fully electric motor coach ride from Charlottetown to Summerside, and that was actually the first time this technology, I guess, was introduced to Canada or as an example.
Is that a big deal?
I guess in today's it was a news article because of it's a fully electric bus, but whether it's a big deal or not, I don't really know.
I don't know. I mean, great, so you have an electric bus. I'm not impressed, but you know, is hydrogen, is that a more suitable platform for mass transit? I mean, Tesla do have transport trucks. In fact, there's several companies now that have transport trucks, so I'm surprised this is the first one. It takes a lot of battery.
It's roughly 250 kilometers per charge. So for a transit bus, that's not really very far.
No, not for PEI. If you're going to Summerside and back,
you're cutting your pretty loose. But imagine if you're trying to go to Moncton or you're trying to go to Halifax or anywhere past the Maritimes.
But that's the range. Can't turn the heat on.
No, no radio, no radio. Yeah. No heat at anything.
Anyway, what's the cost of this thing? Is this a feasible sort of a...
No.
Oh, okay.
So for one unit or one bus, it costs roughly $1.3 million.
How much per fare for that ride?
It's going to cost you $60. bucks a trip. Yeah. No, I really don't know how they would, how government would either subsidize that or how.
Or would they want to?
Would they want to? I think the plan is down the road, it'll likely get better range and cheaper products, but in the short term, it's really not a reasonable investment if you want to make sure you're covering healthcare, education, social programming. If you're trying to focus on transit.
So the Premier talked about having school buses deployed for mass transit. I mean, is that an option?
Obviously, these buses are a little bigger than school buses, but for 1.3 million, let's say even if it's half of that, it's over 600,000.
Yeah.
It's not going to bode well with the taxpayers.
It's a novelty, and maybe they should do a hybrid or something and transition.
There's more research to be done, and like obviously, I think we have to go that way eventually, but just the costing is just, it's kind of hard to look at and say, that's a good idea.
Here's a suggestion for Mr. Okay. Myers. Like, why don't we take a fleet of Teslas and let them be autonomously driven from Summerside to Charlottetown? You can have a corridor going back and forth. So let's take that 1.3 million. Let's encourage people to adopt personal,
right,
autonomous electric
people that are driving
vehicles
more often and in smaller groups than a busload, let's say.
Yeah. Anyway, that's another electrification option.
Also this week in provincial politics, the PEI legislature will be back in action soon, usually the first week of April.
Are you holding your breath?
I'm not holding my breath.
Okay.
No.
You're not excited about this?
Oh, I'm excited. Like, I'm always excited to watch our politicians get up and say what's on their minds. But this is going to be the first, I don't know how you want to say it, but the first time the PCs will have to introduce their own budget, because they went back on the last budget last year and said, this is 95% Liberal, whatever the percentage was. We're going to run with what has been working, so we're going to do that. But now, time's up.
They get to announce their own budget.
It's their own budget. It's interesting to see what they'll say. The biggest concern that was in the news this week was our debt levels. So PEI's provincial debt load currently sits at $2.24 billion. And just to put that in kind of per islander perspective, it's $14,468 per islander.
So that's just provincial debt. That doesn't...
Provincial debt. No, and
there's federal debt.
Federal debt's
personal
a lot more.
Debt.
We're just talking about what the PCs have to do to kind of maybe take a different approach to how they can keep this debt down or to start paying it off. So we still are the lowest in the Maritimes, but it's
doesn't
not...
doesn't matter. You don't want to compare yourself to the bottom.
No, exactly. We're the top of the barrel, and we have a sustainable future to look forward to. I do, anyways.
We're the first of the losers, and that's not a good place to
no.
be.
And if I want to be here for a long time, I want to grow up and have a family in Prince Edward Island. What does that mean for me in the next 20 years if our debt continues to rise?
Or for your kids. And Stephen Myers, to his credit, has always said, we don't want to handcuff future generations. So I'll be curious to see how the government manages that, because the economy has been strong. So this budget should have some allocation for managing debt. I'm not sure the economy can't stay strong. So we've had the longest bull run in history. We're maybe into a bit of a...
foreshadowing our next segment.
Well, let's not do that too much, but I think, you know, you got to be aware that the good times don't last forever,
right,
and you got to manage your finances appropriately.
So, a last little tidbit on the budget. They interviewed former Finance Minister Heath MacDonald, the former Liberal Finance Minister, to see what he thinks kind of about our debt payments each year and what should be done. So, from his perspective, he believes that debt payments should be done on how much, a percentage of what the province actually brings in and not a set number every year, because things can happen, your revenues could go down, such as the coronavirus, it could have an impact on the economy.
So a static percentage...
versus keeping it at a certain number of million every year, have it as a percentage, a varying percentage to say, okay, no, we don't want to... we don't want to take away from these programming because the province didn't make enough money this year, essentially,
so
to pay off the debt.
As opposed to never paying anything,
exactly,
on debt, which is historically what happened.
Well, the last couple of years we've been pretty good, but...
you know, I looked at this not recently, but I think over like a 17-year span, they may have had balanced budgets three or four times.
Mm-hmm.
There's a habitual tendency to overspend and not manage debt. People can't do that personally. And government has an obligation to spend money, and it keeps the economy strong, but we do got to get this debt under control.
What will happen in the future, we don't know. That's why we're not in those positions to make the decisions. But
and so happy to not be there.
We'll offer our insight where we can. So I guess the question from that is, what should government do? There's 100 different options, but let's say if you're not going to pay off your credit card bill at the end of the month, what happens? You get dinged with more charges, and those just keep adding up until you pay off your principal, pay off your debt.
And, you know, right now our bond rating is probably pretty good,
mm-hmm,
by relative standards. If that changed, the interest rate goes up. So you're more punitively kind of affected by interest rate changes, which, you know, I don't know what, I mean, if you looked at the 10-year yield in the U.S. was under 5% for several days. So the bond situation is crazy. The interest rates, I guess, as a consequence, are very abnormal.
Right, so that's a good segue into...
And a good time to pay debt when the interest rates are low. But anyway, okay, exactly. Now to the segue.
Segue into the next segment, economy experts with none other than Blake Doyle. So what's happened in the markets slash economy this week, Blake?
I don't know. I was hoping you knew. I got set up. So the markets have been gyrating. I mean, it's funny, about 10 days ago, we were at all-time peaks for stock market activity. And, you know, as a consequence of the coronavirus, which continues to evolve, I think the market was in some respects waiting for some kind of a shoe to drop. So there'd be kind of a pullback. It does need a little bit of a pullback. It's been strong. But I think the full impact of this coronavirus is far from materializing yet. We talked about some of the impacts. You've mentioned some, I mean, there's school cancellations. So I've got kids in high school. Their school trips to Europe have been canceled, and the impacts of that, there's conferences that are being canceled, there's sporting events being canceled, and there's people that wouldn't go to restaurants. So I think in the short run, you can adapt to that. And today, Walmart announced that they're going to accommodate people if they catch a virus by paying them for 14 days, and then there's an additional 26 days of payment. Most companies probably can't absorb that.
No.
So the impact of the economy is job impact, job loss, correction, and then it takes a long time to build that steam engine back up. So, I mean, some of the things you noticed as far as cancellations.
So on Monday, that just in terms of, oh, I guess in cancellations, so in California, the count, I forget which county it was, but they said no mass gatherings. So you can define that as you will, but essentially they're saying...
It's like North Korea.
Yeah, they're saying the San Jose Sharks, you can't have any fans in the audience for your game. So they're upwards of 20,000 people in the rink.
Right.
What's that multiplication factor on the jobs, the income lost? Obviously, I don't feel bad for some NHL owners, the amount of money they are making, but the people working for them,
sure.
What does that mean for them? The security guards, the concession stand, the anything
that the hotels
makes,
in the area,
makes
everything
the rink go around,
that.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think these impacts, so certainly the travel industry has seen it, for sure. I mean, I know because I checked on it, the seat bookings and airlines has
right.
decreased.
Cruise ships, I checked Expedia yesterday.
Their stock dropped today.
It went from $3,000 week cruise to wherever. It's now about $400 to $450 for a cruise, a week cruise.
Well, so the good thing is if you pay for a week, you get two.
You know, three, technically.
14 days.
Yeah. The quarantine afterwards. But yeah, like how does a cruise ship stay in business if it's empty?
So there's a big impact for PEI. So when they're doing the budget projections, the tourism industry is going to affect their budget, and hopefully they've considered that. I'm sure they're scrambling now to try to accommodate it. I guess Alberta didn't accommodate some of these oil shocks, and it might come back up, but not soon. So I think the impacts of this virus, which is a silly thing. I mean, you can't live in fear. We aren't immune to it. There's no vaccine. We're going to get it. Some large percentage of the population. I think in Italy have locked things down. I think part of the rationale locked down territories is to make sure that it doesn't spread so they can manage the spread and manage the healthcare because people are going to get affected.
Big time. So just to put it in kind of, I guess, in an example of what the stock market did on Monday. So the Canadian stock market had its worst day since the crash of 1987, and it went down over 10.3%.
Black Monday.
Yeah. Scary stuff.
I remember that from being in school. I probably don't remember that.
I was 10 years before I was born, so.
Yeah, there's horrifying. That was a horrifying situation that was a little bit beyond me. More recently, 2008.
I mean,
some of these inflection points where you just really don't know. And there's not enough data to really understand what happens when the entire housing market collapses. This is another one. People are trying to get their heads around.
And from a U.S. perspective, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 2,000 points. So that equals about 7.8%. And that's also...
It's enough to stop trading.
Exactly. So the circuit breakers were triggered in all the stock markets to say... Okay, no, let's stop for a second. Let's figure this out. And I don't think they figured it out yet, but... So the averages were all down over 7%. So the S&P 500 was down 7.6, NASDAQ was down 7.3, and it doesn't look good this week in terms of any kind of
the market's still trying to calibrate this stuff and stabilize. I think it's going to bounce around, and I think it's a couple quarters out. I mean, the economy was pretty strong, and earnings were strong, and job growth has been strong. This is going to whack them.
Big time. So anyways, we won't worry about too much about the stock markets, but daylight savings time happened this past weekend.
Some controversy about that.
A lot of people, and more the people are saying, why the heck do we have this going on?
You know, it used to be the penny. Finally, we abolished the penny. You know, I don't know what's next, the fixed link tolls, but this certainly has become a bit of a catalyst
for
people.
Let's get rid of it, because more and more provinces or territories are kind of saying, okay, well, let's do that. Some provinces have it that they don't change. But what effects, if any, would it have on the economy? Because I know depression rates are usually higher because of daylight savings time. Little things that people wouldn't really think of until, I lost an hour of sleep.
Right. Yeah, and I think that impact, certainly when you got a bunch of kids getting ready for school, that first right. day after the change is a bit of an adjustment. I mean, the rationale behind it was an agrarian part of our economy, which is still important, but not as big an impact, probably, at least in the springtime. I don't know. I don't have an. I mean, I can adapt to the current, but
it's irrelevant. You never sleep anyway, so it doesn't affect
I'm
you.
I'm up before sunrise, so. But it is. I don't know.
The only plus side I see is that it's lighter at night, so you're not driving in the dark anymore. But you kind of see that glimpse of spring in the air. You're like,
you
okay, it's closer and closer.
You feel better with the longer days, and you notice it when that daylight shifts. Although I hate losing it in the mornings because that's a nice time of day too.
Exactly so. for all the activities you do in the morning. So that wraps up economy experts. Now I guess we'll talk about it for a sec, but transfer over to our Doug McLean interview. We talked about it a bit at the start, just kind of the impact Doug has had on Summerside and as Prince Edward Island as a whole, being so proud and always trying to take PEI with him, whether it's promoting players that are up and coming, promoting coaches such as Gerard Gallant, like he talked about a lot.
Mike Kelly,
exactly. Jim Clark's another one who was a scout with him, all from Summerside area. Or I guess Mike was not exactly a Dave Cameron, another one.
Yep.
So it's pretty cool to say how once one person makes it, it's kind of like a team effort. It's like, you guys are coming with me because who else do I trust more than you guys?
And his impact has been pretty widespread for hockey, but for PEI. Like, we've put PEI on the national stage, and you can try to trace back. There's other people, and he mentioned some of these people in the interview that were kind of people who mentored him, but you can really trace Doug Land's impact. Doug McLean's impact and Gerard Glantz's right. impact on PEI.
And people like, we talked about Alan Andrews with him, just to kind of how big of a reach Alan Andrews actually has and putting PEI in the map.
Yeah. No, it's good. He was very kind with his time. And another great guest in the exchange. Sam was set that one up. And
trying my best, yeah.
No, we very good. So should we turn it over to
We will now turn it over to Doug McLean. Doug McLean is a former NHL president, GM, and coach. He spent the last number of years as a hockey analyst with Rogers Sportsnet. He's a proud Summerside PEI native and UPEI Panther alumni. We are happy to have him on the exchange today. Welcome, Doug.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
We're delighted to have you here, and we appreciate you joining us. Where are you from today? You're connecting from...
Well, actually, I live in Florida, so, we've had a place down here. Actually, going back to my Panther days when I coached the Panthers, and we sort of decided after leaving Columbus that we would make Florida our home base, and we're U.S. residents, so we spend, 7.5 months in Florida. Now, when I was working with Sportsnet, I commuted every week. I'd fly up on a Wednesday morning and back here on a Saturday morning. And, when I retired in June, it's sort of been my first full year in Florida. So I'm actually unbelievably busy golfing 3 days a week and doing some rather interesting things. So I'm really enjoying my first year where I'm sort of semi-retired, but a long way from retired.
There's always things going on, eh?
Well, there is. I mean, obviously, I'm writing a book, which has been an unbelievable challenge for me. Simon & Schuster contacted me in June and asked if I would be interested in doing a book, and it's really, I think it's actually, I just finished chapter 5 yesterday, and I'm telling you, it's overwhelming to, for me, all I've ever written in my life since college was emails, I think. So it's sort of a challenge to do a 12 chapter, 70,000 page or word book. So it's actually all about the draft. It's called Draft Day with Doug McLean, and it's all about the draft, the 22 years of me being involved in the draft. They're trying to make it like a money ball of hockey. So it's really an interesting project for me, but to say it's not overwhelming, I'd be lying.
Well, that's pretty interesting. Is this your first attempt outside of emails to draft something of this magnitude?
This is the first attempt to draft a book to say, yeah, for sure. And I have a ghostwriter, Scott Morrison, who was a sports editor for the Toronto Sun and also worked with me at Sportsnet in the past. But still, I've got to put the words together and get it to him for fine-tuning. But it is interesting. I mean, the research has been very interesting. But, you know, I've gone back, as I said, my 22 drafts and all the other stories around the draft. So I think it's interesting. I don't know if anybody else is going to find it interesting, but I, you know, it's been a great project. I probably spend, you know, 10 hours a week on the project, and some days I get into it. Yesterday I spent 5 hours. You know, I get into a section, you know, on it, and I sort of was enjoying it. So it was stories around the draft. I mean, I'll give you an example of what is in it. Is we're at the 2003 draft, I believe, and the table next to us, Phoenix Coyotes, made their pick. And they selected a player, and everybody on the draft floor were shaking their heads and basically laughing at the Phoenix Coyotes for making this pick of a player who was rated well into the second round on most teams' lists. So Mike Burnett and Gretzky were so ticked off about the selection and the response of the other teams that they fired their scouting staff after the draft. Well, the player turned out to be Blake Wheeler.
He's got a great first name.
Exactly. Blake Wheeler went on to have a pretty good NHL career, and as a matter of fact, he's the captain of the Winnipeg Jets right now. So maybe their staff was a lot smarter than every other staff in the NHL. So, you know, I mean, it's sort of draft stories and how the draft works and how scouting works. So it's kind of an interesting project for hockey people to read, I hope. You know?
Definitely. Well, we'll be picking up a copy. But just kind of scale it back a bit. At what point did you kind of think, okay, I'm going to be a coach and I want to coach at the highest level. I want to coach in the NHL. Was there a certain point that you said, yep, that's what I'm going to do?
You know what? I finished at UPEI and I started teaching high school at Summerside. And, you know, I was coaching the Bantam team there. And then I was sort of, while I was finishing up university, I coached a Bantam B team in Summerside. And then I got a job teaching at Holland College, and I took the high school coaching job there. So I did that for 1 year, and at that time, Forbes Kennedy was coaching the Summerside Crystals, and he moved to Tignish. He got a big coaching deal to move to Tignish to coach a new team in Tignish. So they hired me to coach the Summerside Crystals, and I was like 23 years of age at the time, and my captain was Pinky Gallant, who unfortunately just passed away a few months ago. Pinky was my captain at 20 years of age, so that was my first run at the coach, and then I did that for a year, and then I got a job at Three Oaks, and they made me leave the coaching with the Crystals because the job was going to be with the school board, and they thought it was going to be too big a job to do both, so I got out of it. Then I went back in 83 and started coaching the Western Capitals, and I was a Summerside Capitals' first ever coach in 83. You know, that's when I sort of thought, gee, you know, my dream would be to coach at a university. It really, I thought, man, if I could ever get a university coaching job, that would be the ultimate. So I taught Summerside for 7 years, and I coached, and then I went back to University of Western Ontario to do my master's, actually in special education, educational psychology. And when I was there, I became assistant coach with the London Knights in the Ontario League. And after that season, University of New Brunswick hired me. So that was my dream job. I think I was around 30 at the time, and I'm thinking, wow, University of New Brunswick, this is the ultimate. I remember Jill and I, my wife, being out to dinner the first night we were in UMB and saying, like, at UMB saying, man, could it be any better than this? I'm coaching university hockey. I'm teaching a course at the university. This is the ultimate job. So I thought I would be at UMB for the next 25 years, guys. I really, really did. And then after 1 year at UMB, I got offered an NHL job in St. Louis. And then I did 22 straight years in the NHL. So it's kind of fluky how it happened. But to come from Summerside and get to the NHL, but by the time I was 31, I thought that was pretty cool.
It's a pretty exceptional path, and I know there's a lot of Islanders pretty proud of what you've accomplished and how you've represented PEI, not just at the National Hockey League, but certainly on Sportsnet and any venue you've touched. You've taken, you've had the most senior roles in the NHL, but you've also introduced a lot of PEI to the world. And there's some pretty successful coaches that you've brought with you and have done very, very well. Talk a little bit about some of these people that you've introduced to from PEI to all over the globe and certainly through your sports connections.
Well, you know, it was always sort of a cool thing when you could help people try to find jobs other than, you know, coaching in PEI if they really wanted to move on. And, you know, guys like Mike Kelly, when he went back to London, I helped him get on with the team there. Dave Cameron, I got him an opportunity to coach in Michigan, and obviously Grant Saunier, guys like that. Sort of, not that I did a whole lot, but I put in a call. And I guess the key was when I started the franchise in Columbus in 1999-2000, I hired Gerard Gallant to be an assistant. Now, I went back to 11 years of age with Gerard when I first met him at the Summerside rink. And as a matter of fact, I taught Gerard in high school. He was in my class. And I'll never forget the day in class I was asking the kids what they wanted to do when they finished school. And Gerard put down what a typical 16-year-old. He said, I want to be a mailman. And I said, you know, Gerard, I think maybe you're going to Sherbrooke for major junior. Maybe you should really focus on hockey a little more than focus on being a mailman. So it was kind of fun to hire him in London, in Columbus. And he was with me for 9 years there. And we had we've had a great relationship over there. So I'm thrilled to watch how he's progressed. And we talk on a regular basis. So I'm pretty proud of him. So it's kind of fun to see. You know, we both coached expansion teams to the Stanley Cup Finals, and unfortunately, both of us got fired in the third year after doing that, so it's kind of frustrating to see, but that's life in the NHL, you know.
Well, it's certainly put Prince Edward Island on the map in terms of the NHL, and what my next question will be kind of how PEI is a small pond, but we've seen some incredible hockey players over the past couple years and past couple decades, really. So do you think that Prince Edward Islanders punch above their weight in terms of work ethic and drive to get to the highest level of hockey? So people like Zach McHugh and Adam McQuaid, even Brad Richards in the past.
Well, you know what? I think when you look at the population base and you say, wow, you know, a lot of guys have played in the National Hockey League. A lot of guys have played in the minors. A lot of guys have coached, moved on in the coaching ranks. I look at the Summerside Western Capitals as an example of a junior A team with 16 or 17 PEI kids on their team. That's unheard of, even at that age level. So, you know, it starts at the grassroots and it goes from there, where guys have had amazing careers. And I guess we shouldn't be surprised. There's great coaching on PEI. There's great minor hockey. Think about what Alan Andrews has done with his program at, you know, the biggest hockey school maybe in the world. I don't know if people realize that, but it might be the biggest hockey school, 2,500 students a year. The coaching that goes on in PEI, the number of rinks we have in PEI. So, you know, and it shouldn't, I guess it doesn't surprise me that we produce a lot of good players, but you know what, I've been lucky to get to know most of the kids that have gone on to play, and I'm really proud when I see names of of locals that are making their way through the major junior college and pro ranks. So, you know, PEI does punch it, you know, punch ahead of its weight class. There's no denying that. And I try to get that word out there. I'm not a big Twitter guy, but I think I have like about 165,000 followers. So I sort of punch it out. And I think a lot of people get sick of me pushing the name PEI out there, but that's kind of always a fun thing to do.
It's a great thing to do. We appreciate it. And you certainly mentioned Alan Anders. I've got some young kids in hockey. And I think the thing that Alan Anders I'm most impressed with, and we do attend his courses, he's not just creating hockey players, he's creating citizens. And he instills some values that are important whether you play professional hockey or you just are a good contributor to your economy. Like, it's a great, great program. He's a great man. One thing you did mention...
You know what?
Go ahead. Sorry, Doug.
Yeah. Well, I just on Alan, you know, I've known... Alan was my assistant coach when I was with the Western Capitals, and we've been great friends all over the years. You're 100% right. My son went to his hockey school. My son actually does some work with him now, and he's out of Chicago. I mean, you're right. He's looking at the well-rounded kid, and he looks at... you know, how to make the kid a better person. And I agree 100%. I think sometimes he doesn't get enough credit for that. But look, PEI's got a lot of wonderful people that have done a lot for kids and hockey and in other areas. So it looks good on the province.
One thing you mentioned a moment ago, you paralleled your conference runs, both for yourself and Gerard's recent one, and then how abrupt the coaching profession is. I mean, it's almost like politics. When you go into the role... probably the first thing you're sure of is that you're going to not last. How is that, and you've gone through it a couple of times, how is that experience to know that despite whatever efforts you put into this, you might just be the scapegoat to make a change?
Well, you know, it's funny. I remember after we went to the Stanley Cup Finals, you know, things are rosy, and I remember it was my first year coaching the Florida Panthers. We were a third-year franchise, and after the season was over, Bill Torrey called me in. He was the president of the team. He said, look, Wayne Huizenga wants to tear up your contract and do a new 3-year contract. And they gave me a great raise. And I thought, okay, this is really cool. Then a year later, Bill Torrey and Brian Murray said, you know, Wayne is not very happy. We went to the Stanley Cup Finals last year. He thought we'd win the Stanley Cup this year. And I'm thinking, are you kidding me? I mean, is he serious? Like, maybe tell him to have a look at his Dolphins and his Marlins and, you know, tell me how they're doing. And, you know, but that's how it worked. And it's funny, I remember sitting with Gerard this summer having a coffee in Summerside saying, Gerard, you know, you lost in the first round this year. You've got an owner that's a little bit crazy. I mean, I'm telling you, if I sat and told you stories about some of my dealings with owners and the number of times I was called at 11 o'clock at night and told to fire my coach, you'd be shocked. You've got guys that are unbelievably successful businessmen who buy hockey teams, and they think that it's like their business and it's going to be as successful as their business. And sometimes... some of them are really intelligent, and some of them are just really lucky that they got where they are. Hmm. And you know what? It really is the frustrating, most frustrating part of the job. I mean, I ended up being in Columbus almost 10 years. It was a great run. But even when I was fired there, I was disappointed. And when I was made to fire Dave King, and then I was made to fire Gerard, and I. When your owner makes you fire a coach, you can't tell the media that, you know, I had to fire him. I had no choice. They think it was you that fired him. And I remember sitting with Gerard the day I had to fire him. I said, Gerard, you know that I do not want to do this, that this is against everything, but I've got no choice here. And he, you know, we stayed good friends despite that, because he knew the truth. And that was one of the toughest days of my career. But owners, people would be shocked if they knew how many times it's the owner that loses his marbles and gets the coach fired, right? Not the GM.
Yeah.
So, you know, getting fired is part of the job. But it doesn't matter if it's part of it or not. It's really, really challenging and tough. And we make a lot of money when we're in the NHL, and we all understand that, and that's a given. But it still doesn't feel very good when you get booted out, I'll tell you that.
Definitely not. And it's so that's as a coach, as a GM, as an owner, as a president, you have to kind of show leadership, whether it's good leadership or bad leadership in some cases. So how important is leadership to you, either in hockey or in life?
Well, you know what? When you're coaching in the NHL, you know, you have to lead and you have to manage the dressing room. And that's a really important. The good coaches get how you manage the group. It's not the systems. We all know the systems. Anybody that's in the NHL coaching, they know the system. They understand the system. They understand the game. They understand how to teach the game. But it's managing the group that is the most important part. And that's managing a group of 30 people inside that dressing room, from the players to the training staff to the equipment staff to the assistant coaches and on and on. So it's management at its highest level, and it's management at an amazingly competitive level, and it's managing for wins, because that's all it's about, is winning. And you've got to manage the group so you keep it moving in a positive direction. And trust me, there's challenges every day of the week with players upset. Like, I had a player come in to me and he was really upset, and he said, why am I on the fourth line? And that's one of the biggest questions you're always asked as a coach. Why am I on the fourth line? And I looked at him and I said, let me tell you why you're on the fourth line. Because I don't have a fifth line. If I had a fifth line, that's where you'd be. So I think the point I'm trying to make is, one of the keys to managing a room and managing a group is honesty and being a straight shooter and telling people exactly where they stand. And I think I look back to all the people and the players I've been involved with in my 22 years in the NHL and my 8 or 10 years in the media, so my 34 years of professional hockey, is I never hardly met a player that I didn't like as a person. A lot of them I didn't like as players, but I didn't. It was very, very few, if any, I didn't like as people. And there's not a guy that I managed or coached that I'd be afraid to sit down and have a beer with, because I think I was honest and straight with them, and I think they appreciated that. And I think in management, that to me is the number one, other than knowing your business, that's the number one trait that I think people, workers or players, expect and, you know, really deserve. And that's sort of, not that it's my, I guess it's sort of my motto, but that's just the way I've tried to operate.
So you mentioned, you know, you've got a pretty varied history now. You're a sportscaster. Clearly, you're a very successful coach. We just found out you're an author, or soon to be an author. From a business perspective, you mentioned honesty, but when you're looking at leadership, and you've had the highest level of leadership in the NHL, how does that translate? Are there traits that would translate over to the business environment as well? Certainly honesty, I think, would. Is there anything else that you think a good leader in hockey can also use in the business environment?
Yeah, I think so. Look, I've been involved in a lot of real estate in my career. I, you know, have a business partner. We've been partners for 20 years, and we built an apartment building in Florida 3 or 4 years ago. We did the apartment project in Summerside. We've done numerous projects throughout the U.S., and, you know, I've done some financing some deals in PEI for people that I'm involved with. So I think about the business side, and I sort of have enjoyed that side as maybe as much as the hockey. And it's been a really positive experience for me. My partner is a guy that I met 20 years ago. We met in my subdivision when I was actually 30 years ago when I was back. Well, I'll tell you when it was. It was 1995, because I was coaching the Panthers when we met. We became great friends, and we've become business partners. So we've done a lot of projects over the years together. So it's I found the business side as exciting as the hockey side, to be quite honest. we did the project in Summerside, which was a big project on a 64-unit building on the waterfront there, and it was one of the more challenging projects of my career, to be quite honest, because we had a contractor from New Brunswick that ran into problems. I had, you know, a number of liens on the property, and we had to pay those out, and I had to move him off the site and bring in a guy to finish the project. So it was without a doubt, one of the most challenging projects of my career. And I remember sitting in a meeting in Summerside with my partner. I'll tell you, I was standing on a street corner in Toronto, and he phoned me. He said, "Doug, we got a little problem." And I said, "What's that, Jeff?" He said, "We got to put $4.5 million cash into the Summerside deal, or the project's going down." And there was a bus coming down the street, and I thought, should I jump out in front of that, or should I keep talking to Jeff? So anyway, and I looked at Jeff, and the two of us made a decision that we were going to put the money in to finish the project, and because of the contractor. And I said, you know, if it would have been a business deal, we would have walked away from the deal. We would have walked away and not finished the project. But because it was in Summerside, because it was in my backyard, Jeff and I agreed we're finishing this project. So you know what? We finished it. The building became a great success, and we just recently sold it in October to a REIT out of Toronto, Cap REIT out of Toronto, who approached us this summer. And it actually sold for the most, it was the most any apartment building on PEI has ever sold for. So it was an unbelievably challenging project, but a very positive one at the end. And it's sort of changed the landscape of Summerside a little bit, on the waterfront in particular. So, I'm really proud of that, but to say it wasn't challenging would be a lie. And I've spent a lot of nights from 3 to 4:30 in the morning thinking about hockey. I spent a lot of nights thinking 3 to 4:30 about apartments, and now between 3 and 4, I'm thinking about my tee shots. They're not where I want them to be. So that's my number one focus now.
Well, you know, that building is a landmark. It's a beautiful building on the waterfront. And one thing, I mean, you've traveled a lot. I mean, we look at your hockey career. You've, from UNB right through, you've been on the road a fair bit. Summerside's a community that has great tenacity, and you think of the hockey mentality. In fact, there's a lot of leaders in Summerside, even economic development leaders, who are very hockey-focused. They've got that that strong mentality. And Summerside punches above its weight. What do you see? And Summerside's changed a lot since you were here with the Caps. How do you see the...
You know what is... I'll tell you what, they're doers. Like when I was coaching the Panthers, just as an example, Billy Schuurman phones me and Basil Stewart. I get a call from them, and I'm busy. I'm in the middle of the season. I'm focused on trying to survive as an NHL coach. And they phone and said, this is in 96. This was right after our Stanley Cup run, or during our Stanley Cup run, actually. And they said, would you consider bringing the Panthers to Summerside for training camp? Now, you know, I'm thinking, gee, that's interesting. So one of the highlights of my career was when we brought the Panthers to Summerside. And why did we do it? Because the people in Summerside went above and beyond to really make it happen. I mean, I was the one that went to Bill Torrey and Wayne Huizenga saying, Brian Murray saying, look, I think this would be an unbelievable place to have our training camp. It would be great for the plus to be around these guys. But it was Summerside that made it happen. And then when I got the job as president GM in Columbus, same thing. They phoned about, would I bring the Blue Jackets to Summerside? And, you know, they were two of my greatest highlights of my career doing that, bringing the teams to Summerside and seeing thousands of people in the rink watching those teams play and practice and the exhibition games and the you know, the response was unreal. So it was pretty cool to do that. But it's the people of Summerside and the leaders of the town that made that happen. It's the same as, the West End property we have that we're involved in with the apartment building. And we financed some deals on the waterfront there where, you know, all of a sudden, what do? They put a $3.5 million boardwalk across the whole front of the property we were involved in. I'm thinking, like, seriously, guys, this is unbelievable. So they changed the town, and anything I've ever, I owned, you know, I was involved in Spinnaker's Landing for a long time and different projects there. And they stepped up and helped me make it happen, to be quite honest.
And that's what we need to see in communities, the smaller communities like Summerside. To get ahead, you need strong leadership. And you've obviously been one of the leaders to come from Summerside. And like you touched on, Mayor Basil Stewart, who's still around all these years later, he continues to see that vision of leadership going forward with his community. So I guess you kind of...
Not only Basil, but like Mike Thruska, who is a development guy. I hear from Mike on a regular basis about projects and about what they're doing and what they're... you know, what they're trying to accomplish there. And, you know, so I think it's the whole group. They've got a mentality there. I mean, just think about this. A $40 million facility in a town of 14,000 people.
Yeah.
A 5,000-seat arena, a couple of swimming pools, a bowling alley, a convention center. It's unbelievable what they've accomplished as a small town. And I have played a very limited part. It's the group there that have done an amazing job when you talk about leadership. And I'm really sincere when I say that.
For sure. So I guess one of the questions I had for you was what your favorite moment in the NHL was, but it seems like it was bringing you having the ability to bring the Panthers and the Columbus Blue Jackets to Summerside. Would that be correct in saying that?
You know, there was so many, you know, amazing highlights, you know. There was small ones, there was big ones. I remember I had a you know, when we won we were trailing in the finals of the conference against Pittsburgh. We were playing against Lemieux and Yager. I mean, they had an unbelievable team. And we went to Pittsburgh for game seven. And if we won game seven, I would be coaching in the Stanley Cup finals. And I'm thinking, I remember walking across the ice that night we won in Pittsburgh to go to the Stanley Cup final. And I remember walking off the ice and Wayne Huizenga, who was this billionaire owner, and Dan Marino, who was the quarterback of the Miami Dolphins, were both grabbing and hugging me. And I'm thinking, like, seriously, this is a long way from PEI that I'm going to coach in the Stanley Cup finals. But you know what? There were so many highlights. I'll never forget coaching in the All-Star game. I coached back-to-back All-Star games. That's when they used to try. And I remember, I'll never forget going to the All-Star game in Boston. Or going to San Jose. First year was in Boston. Ray Bourque scored the winning goal with 5 minutes left to win five, or with a minute left to win 5-4. The next year, I was going to San Jose to the All-Star game, and my son Clark was a big hockey fan. He was 9 at the time, and he's a big hockey fan. So I phoned, and he was a stick collector. So I phoned Mike Burnett, Wayne Gretzky's agent. I said, is there any way Wayne could bring one of those silver Easton sticks? Clark would love to have it, and he's going to be at the All-Star game. Sure, sure, sure. So anyway, you go to the All-Star game. Wayne Gretzky has a silver stick. First day he walks in the room. Clark's 9. He gives him the stick and signs it, your friend Wayne Gretzky. Clark's the stick boy for the 2 days. He runs around the dressing room. He comes on the bench in the All-Star game, and one of the highlights of my life is to have him standing next to me on the bench the whole game as he was a stick boy. And after the game, Wayne called him over into the dressing room, takes off his game-worn NHL All-Star jersey, and presents it to Clark and signs it, to Clark, your friend Wayne Gretzky. And he has that to this day, framed in his home. And I think, how cool is that, that Wayne Gretzky would do that for a 9-year-old. So probably a year and a half later, I'm in Columbus and I meet Wayne and Schwarzenegger. We're in Columbus for the big opening of the limited Victoria's Secret. We're opening this big mall there. I meet them at the mall. I said to Wayne, I can't believe you did that for Clark. I just can't believe you'd do that. And he said, Doug, I hope he enjoys it, because he said, I'm still in shit with the NHL for giving it to him.
So, that's a pretty special moment for you, Clark.
There was so many exciting moments over the years, and proud moments and fun moments. But it's just the people you run into, and the And imagine doing your career, your hobby as your career. I think that's the luckiest break anybody can ever have, you know.
Fair enough. So before we wrap up, I have one last kind of question for you. It's a T-ball question, we'll say. What's your favorite part about PEI?
Oh, favorite part about PEI. You know what? I'll tell you my most favorite part of PEI is that I've spent the last... Jill and I have been married 42 years. We have spent every summer in PEI all 42 years. She's an Ontario girl I met in Ontario. And she's came to PEI, and we've been there 42 straight summers for at least 2 months of summer. We have a place there at Chilton Beach. And my kids, Clark was born in St. Louis when I was with the Blues. Mackenzie was born in Detroit when I was with the Red Wings. And if you asked either one of them, Mackenzie lives in Florida, Clark lives in Chicago, if you asked either one of them where they're from, and they will say, I'm from PEI. And they can't wait to get there in the summer. And they have lifelong friends there. And we have lifelong friends. And I think that's what's the most special thing for Jill and I about PEI is the unbelievable lifelong. I mean, George Matthews, I met in grade 8. We're best of friends and we talk once a week. And he worked for me for 12 years in Columbus. Jory Gallant. Jim Clark, I met him in grade 2. Clark McLean, my son is named after him. We met in grade 2. Jim's with the Ottawa Senators now and was with me for 10 years in Columbus. I mean, I guess that's the most special thing that I think about when I think of PEI.
Well, certainly PEI has had an impact on you, but there's no question you've had a substantial impact on PEI. You've opened doors for Islanders. You've demonstrated leadership. You've raised the bar, and you've been a tremendous ambassador for PEI. Thanks for everything you've done, and thanks for sharing your time here with us today.
I think that's a good place to wrap up, and we appreciate your time, Doug. We know you're busy getting ready for your next golf round tomorrow, but we'll catch you for a beer this summer.
Guys, really enjoyed it. Great conversation, and all the best to you guys.
Awesome.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Doug. We'll be in touch. So that was the one and only Doug McLean, our feature interview for episode 4.
What a great interview.
It was awesome.
You know, we have had a pretty successful run, so that's only 4 of these exchange podcasts that we've done, and we do have a couple of great guests that are in the wings. I know they're anxious to see their podcast come out.
Their travel schedules don't align until later next month, but that's okay.
Well, there's people recorded that are kind of waiting to get released, and everybody will get on, and we encourage more people to participate. It's been a great experience, but as far as Doug goes, for me, it was quite interesting to hear about elements of his past, and I guess one of the things that we asked him about was leadership and how he equated that to business and hockey, and actually our quote, I think we have that,
the soundbite of him saying that if I had a fifth line, you'd be on that too.
That's pretty good. So there's some gems
in this
conversation.
That's where I play the fifth line.
Yeah, well, and I'm not I'm in the stands cutting oranges.
Just from someone who like idolized hockey players growing up, and I thought when I was a kid I was going to the NHL, obviously that dream was
look where you are now. You're far from the NHL.
That dream was smashed at probably around Pee Wee when I was 12 or so. But just to be able to listen to someone who's been there for so long, I was still like nervous during the interview because obviously I met him before and I had served him at restaurants when he's back on PEI. But it was just to say, okay, this guy literally coached Wayne Gretzky in the All-Star game.
Yeah.
He's close friends with all these people. Wayne Ezinga, who was the owner of the Dolphins, the owner of the Florida Panthers, the owner of the... What's the other team? The Miami Marlins, the baseball team. So just to be able to, he met this multimillionaire, almost billionaire, who actually, I guess Wayne Ezinga owned Waste Management. That's his company.
Okay.
That's what kind of made it. But anyways, to say like someone who I can idolize in business, but also you coached Wayne Gretzky, Mario Lemieux in the All-Star game. It's like, you can't get any closer to the NHL than through Doug McLean.
Yeah, and he's a very proud Islander. He, even in the podcast, he spoke highly of his Summerside colleagues and
him and his wife have been married 42 years, he said, and they've been here every summer. And they spend it, I guess it's kind of close to Summerside where they stay, but I work at the Landmark Oyster House in Victoria part time in the summer, and I served him probably 6 or 7 times. Like, he's there a lot.
Pretty genuine, down to earth kind
awesome
of guy.
Awesome guy, yeah. And he always say, what's going on today? What's going on in your life? What's on tap today that's local?
Yeah. Well, certainly he was very accommodating, endearing, very generous with his time again during this podcast. And he talked about his future. So aside from golf, we don't know how he golfs, but he does spend some time on the golf course. He talks about a book that he's writing, which is
Draft Day.
And he's done 22 drafts, I think, through his...
Yeah, 20. So he was an executive or a coach or whatever at the draft for 22 years, and then another 10 years as an analyst through Sportsnet. He had to cover drafts, essentially. But to be able to... You're not going to find more experience than that.
So to get that perspective, even for young hockey players...
The analytics involved, even back before there was actually technology, so let's say, but did the analytics involve, say, how do you rank who you're going to pick in the draft? What, like, the crazy stories, and this story in the interview about Blake Wheeler, who's one of the best players in the NHL right now.
No relation to me.
No, I'm different Blake. But they thought this team was nuts for picking him so soon. It's right. Like, well, clearly there's something more to it than we actually see.
So the money puck.
Money.
There are analytics do have value. And
exactly.
That's
and that's, I think we share that every day, the value of analytics.
So, no, I guess very gracious, happy for this podcast, and happy to have
the opportunity to have Doug on. And looking forward to next week. I don't know what next week will bring. We'll decide.
Let's just wait.
We'll decide.
Stay tuned.
Maybe.
Yeah, exactly. We're hitting a pretty high plateau, so the next one will have to be better, which it will be.
Exactly. Anyways, so this has been The Exchange, Episode 4, presented by Confederation Group. I'm Sam McPhail, and my co-host beside me is Blake Doyle. We will sign off and see you next week.
Have a good week.